Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 111, where we are discussing a 1999 article from Susan Leigh Starr titled Layers of Silence, Arenas of Voice, The Ecology of Visible and Invisible Work, co-authored posthumously with Anselm Strauss and published in the journal Computer Supported Cooperative Work. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Rohin from London.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
This is Sam calling from Mexico City.
And this is Pedro calling from Copenhagen.
And Greta here from Dordrecht.
Welcome all. And where we're going to cover Susan Leigh Starr and Anselm Strauss's 1999 article, Layers of Silence, Arenas of Voice, The Ecology of Visible and Invisible Work. Susan Leigh Starr was a subject of a professional development workshop that Pedro and Greta hosted a few years back. And so Susan Leigh Starr has been high on our list of authors that we've wanted to examine. So this is a great opportunity to examine what is probably one of her best-known works. Anybody want to give a quick overview of Susan and her work?
Yeah, sure. I can take a crack. Just for the listeners, I would like to say that episode is episode 82. And there you also find the contributions about some other great women from organizational scholarship. So a little bit about Susan Leigh Starr. She was an American sociologist. I think most of our listeners will know her from her contribution on boundary objects. She was one that coined the concept, but she did, of course, much more than that. She's someone that has studied at length information in modern society. She has studied also classifications, standardization, medicine, science, technology. You know, she's someone that has interested in this kind of settings and trying to understand how information is stored, layered, make visible, invisible, and how that has consequences for work that people do. She's also someone associated with the computer-supported cooperative work community, and that's, you know, the paper today is contributing to that. Just for our listeners, maybe just to say computer-supported cooperative work, also known as a CSCW, is what it says on the can. It's basically a group of people that are interested in studying how technology supports collaboration, right? It's particularly in looking at how computer systems can support cooperative activity. And of course, the paper is with Anselm Strauss, which, as far as I understand, was Susan's mentor. He's, of course, a very famous sociologist that needs no introduction, has done a lot of contributions to medical sociology. But again, together with Berner and Glaser, perhaps is most well known from the creation of grounded theory. So that's what we are working off here, you know, with the Chicago school tradition, people that were interested in getting close to how the work is done and understanding it. And that's exactly, you know, one of the core topics of the paper we're going to go now and try to explore.
I'm reading just now on Wikipedia that Susan Leigh Starr was also the president of the Society for the Social Studies of Science, 2005 to 2007. So I think that's a big recognition of, the contribution of her work.
One important thing I forgot to say, and honestly, maybe that's why I'm such a big fan of her work. She created, I don't know if it was together with Geoffrey Bowker and others, the Society for the Study of Boring Things. Because as she says, given her interest in science, technology, medicine, she was, however, interested at the mundane tools and artifacts and elements of such fields, right? In looking exactly how classification of diseases or how the way in forms and how we write information on them, how maps are used, how representations and images are used in science shape such activities to a great extent. And other people were also looking at different things in the same way, right? I think this idea is very well captured in a very great paper she has called The Ethnography of Infrastructure, in which she shows exactly how paying attention to these ordinary things are quite revelatory of so-and-so big phenomena from inequality and power and injustice and so on, but always coming from a very bottom-up way, right? And I think that this society that she created is a great representation of this kind of theoretical perspective that she has so great developed in her life.
I think that's very well put, Pedro. And I'll just add from the obituary that Ellen Balka wrote upon Susan Starr's death, she kind of quoted Starr saying in 2007, "I have been trying for about the last 20 years to link the following three dimensions, lived experience, technologies, and silences." So I think that's really kind of helps us introduce the text today, but it's also kind of a really nice summary of what I think you've been saying of her focus on kind of talking about the things that we don't really appreciate or talk about or see in organizations.
And so the article itself, it begins with a very interesting first section, which is titled, "What Counts as Work is a Matter of Definition, : the Big Picture." Just following on those themes, this is how she starts. She starts with raising some questions about what is work, while at the same time trying to distinguish between what is visible and invisible. She also introduces or brings in some of her previous work about some other categories of work, like articulation work, which shows up in the second paragraph. Work that gets things back on track in the face of the unexpected and modifies action to accommodate anticipated contingencies. Things like what organizations do when they're reacting to a crisis or something that they weren't anticipating. And contrasts that with cooperative work, the work of collaboration. So she's doing, she opens the paper with quite a lot of scene setting steps. What I thought was kind of an interesting approach was drawing from a famous novel by Toni Morrison, an entire passage in which not just how work is defined, but who gets, the whole point of the passage was who gets to define the work. And so this is how she starts with the talking about the, you know, the meaning of the definition of work and then how we see, you know, what's visible and invisible.
I just want to kind of follow up on what Tom said. I think the way I would summarize what this paper is about, it's really, they make kind of these key arguments, which is, you know, what is work is not a given, and it's not always obvious what counts as work and what doesn't count as work. And what determines what counts as work, you know, what is visible or invisible, is negotiated and is situated, and it depends on the context. And this context is always changing. I think that's how I would summarize the main idea of this paper.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing that I really appreciated about how they started off the paper is they move it from the terrain of something simple, let's say, like, do you see the work happening or not, or something either physical or in kind of space and time, to the terrain of definition and meaning. And so what is work or not, what is visible or invisible work can be a matter of definition. And then that brings in the kind of negotiation between, let's say, the worker and the receiver of the output. And so sometimes invisibility then is not necessarily about observation. It's about divergence in definition, where the worker might think it is work, but the receiver might think it's not. And so from a certain angle, it's invisible versus from the lived experience of the worker, it's, of course, highly visible or crucial. She also, in the very beginning, kind of sets it against, for example, the backdrop of the feminist movement and claiming all the work that happens in the household that might not be economically compensated, but is still work. And how kind of that weaves into this idea of how the definitions can change over time, and hence our idea of what is work can change over time, and something that was invisible can become visible rather than anything being hard-coded to the nature of work necessarily.
It's important to say that this was published in a computer-supported cooperative work journal, right? Which usually is a community that is not interested only in understanding collaboration, work, and technology, but also designing such technologies for such purposes. So you can see that in the paper, they're trying to bring sociological ideas about work, as what you are saying, this understanding of meaning, to try to provide some principles, heuristics, for the design and get exactly what you're saying, Raheem. Move the conversation from just saying, is this on a flow chart or not? But actually, even if it is in a flow chart, it might still be invisible, or making it visible sometimes might actually make other things invisible in the process. So one can say that they are bringing, of course, Anselm Strauss and Starr are related to the symbolic interactionist school, right? Which is this idea that people respond to elements in their environment according to subjective meanings they attach to those elements, right? So that exactly in the interaction, people attribute meaning, and that meaning shapes on how we interact and therefore construct the world in this way, which is exactly why some things like women's work is hard labor, but is understood, is attached with meaning that dissociates that with the category that we associate to work.
Yeah, definitely, Pedro. And I think the concern that the authors raise in this paper are well expressed in the abstract. And since the publication of this paper, its relevance goes way beyond the community of computer-supported cooperative work. So what I liked in the paper is, like, we always see work through a selection of indicators, the authors say, like straining muscles, finished artifacts, and changed state of affairs. And the indicators change with context, that I found an important one. And that context becomes a negotiation about the relationship between the visible and invisible work. And with shifts in industrial practice, these negotiations require longer chains of inference and representation and may become solely abstract. And I think that's where really the message of the authors comes in. Like, work is not apolitical. What defines as work, as visible work or real work? Sometimes we as academics say we don't have time for the real work. We only have to do the necessary stuff. But it's a negotiation. And as the way we work, the way work is structured in industrial contexts, perhaps we should become aware of what negotiation is happening and what the abstraction of this negotiation process does and means for us.
And I think one last thing that we should probably mention just to contextualize the paper, because I feel the authors are all also kind of writing in reaction to these big management changes, right? About how work is being restructured in organizations. Both, they give examples both of private corporations and public organizations, and they kind of, you know, they say we're kind of outsourcing, freelancing is becoming a thing. And so with all of these changes, what you see is basically a change in the ecology of what's visible and invisible work. And I think that's also important to kind of understand maybe who are they writing to, right?
Yeah, one aspect I really liked, because I feel like we've talked a little bit about the power and who defines and the negotiation. And I think that is definitely the purpose of this article and what's key. But they've also added the other sociological angle of changing frame of reference defines what the work is. So a quote that I really like from section one, and to me is kind of the crux of it, is on page 13 on my printout, but it says, they say, it is clear here that definition is all, both in the relative sense of frame of reference and in the brute sense of who gets to define the work's meaning. And so the brute sense is some of the examples we talked about, household work, who's defining what work is. But the frame of reference, they use a very kind of nifty example, I suppose, of nuns and the idea that you might not think of prayer as work, but often in these monasteries or other places, people go and ask the nuns to pray on their behalf, on the behalf of an ailing, you know, family member or something like that. And they have literal backlogs of prayer requests to follow up on. And so the same activity then in a different frame of reference, in this case, the frame of reference is that it's in service of others, becomes work. And then the frame of reference is culturally defined. It got me thinking about how, as per with the nun example, if I sat and just meditated by myself, it probably wouldn't be work because it's just me, you know, meditating, and they use that example as a counter. But in today's world, it would just be called, you know, self-work or working on myself. So that maybe, you know, something as society becomes more individualistic, there's more frames of reference for what work is, and it's in service of whom.
Yeah, definitely. And also in the paper, they kind of make this interesting distinction, right, in two types of work that matter in CSCW, computer-supported collaborative work. And one is articulation work, which I felt like was a concept introduced by Anselm Strauss, and very much this paper is an elaboration of the works he already published on that topic. And Susan Leistar writes, like halfway writing this paper, he passed away. He's still mentioned as an author. So articulation work is one, and then the other one is a cooperative work. They kind of opposed the two. And it's on page 10, I think, where they give a definition. Articulation work is work that gets things back on track in the face of the unexpected and modifies action to accommodate unanticipated contingencies. The important thing about articulation work is that it is invisible to rationalized models of work. And then cooperative work, they see as interleaves distributed tasks. And articulation work here manages the consequences of the distributed nature of work. So it's highly complex dynamic, and there's a recursive relationship between the two.
Yes, and I think what the authors are trying to do is kind of add this dimension of visible, invisible work to our understanding and our management of articulation work, right? Because they say, shortly after defining articulation work, they say it means developing a subtle analysis of the politics and culture of the work to be supported, one which distinguishes the routine from the exceptional and which does not violate contextual norms. So here you can already see how this recognition of what counts as work is always being defined and redefined. And we need to kind of pay attention of what we're not counting as work and what we're not making visible, and how changes maybe or attempts to manage or transform articulation work can actually have, you know, if we don't recognize this visibility or invisibility dimension, then it can have unexpected and often unwanted consequences. And I think another thing that I wanted to add, and this we can discuss this later because they kind of make this point later on the paper as well, but they say it from the start. It's not inherently bad that work is invisible sometimes, right? They do mention in that first part that there are trade-offs involved in making work visible. So, on the one hand, there's recognition and there's legitimacy when you make work visible, but also when you make it visible, then you increase kind of surveillance, and these can have a negative effect on both the work and the workers that are doing this kind of work. So I think, you know, it's worth mentioning now as well.
How I understood the paper, to go back to, you know, what we have been saying, is that this was probably written in a place, in a time of computerization, I cannot pronounce this thing, but the arrival of, you know, information technologies of all types, and probably the same way we have today, and maybe we can come back to this in part two, you know, nowadays we have with digitalization, but there is this idea that these electronic systems are make possible to record everything, to have processes that are more rational and representative and closer to the reality, so to speak, right? And as you're all saying, she's adding this dimension that visibility is just not a matter of writing things down because it's contextual and political, but also, and I think that's the second part of the paper that I understand, she's trying to say, not only she, they are trying to say, that invisibility actually can be a positive thing, can be enabling, right? Because too much visibility can take away discretion, they take away the possibility of people to define in their own corners what they understand the work to be and how it should be carried out, right? So there is this exactly tension that they're trying to bring that is not just about any kind of vision in which the goal is to just render everything visible, but actually to navigate the different trade-offs that exist into that.
Yeah, I think when we get into the second part, it is, you know, on the one hand, they're trying to say, you know, exactly what you said about that, you know, visible and invisible is not inherently good, bad, or what have you. But there is a tone that hints towards that invisible work is inherently underappreciated, or that it needs to be more visible than it is because the reasons for invisibility are perhaps linked more to power and status differences or some other elements of the environment rather than the nature and character of the work being performed. And I sort of took that like in the second part when they explain range of instances and the kinds of conversations about silences that are engendered, they offer three categories. This is in my version here, it's on page 15. The first one, creating a non-person, for example, which covers, I'll just read it. The act of working or the product of work is visible to both employer and employee, but the employee is invisible. Being a former ghostwriter, I know exactly what they're talking about. I can share those experiences later. The very term non-person just sort of hints at a undesirability in my mind. It was hard for me to read that without interpreting it as meaning that this is something that is, maybe it's my old reading of George Orwell's 1984 coming back or something, but you know, just that connotation of invisibility, therefore being undesirable, sort of came out to me. So I had to read it a couple of times to appreciate the more nuanced, the more balanced discussion that they were having. Because even in the subsection, so each of these, creating a non-person, disembedding background work, and abstracting and manipulating of indicators, each one gets its own subsection. Much of the creating a non-person section is talk specifically about domestic workers, who are people who do some really hard work that is largely invisible, and then talk about some of the implications of the negotiation.
If I can just, I mean, yeah, we can go into each of those three types in time, but I just want to zoom out for a second, because I think what y'all are talking about is something I experienced while I was reading this, where this kind of bookend the paper in the beginning and ending by bringing up the tensions where visibility and invisibility aren't necessarily good or bad. Visibility can lead to more, you know, communication costs or articulation work. They literally use the phrase positive invisibility in the latter part of the paper. But in between, they drop that and they focus on more of what you were saying, Tom, the way you felt while reading these categories, for example, where it seemed like invisible work is almost an oxymoron, or it's like not yet properly recognized. It just means that there's a divergence in definition, and the low power and status person sees the work and the high power and status doesn't see it. Once you see it, and then by definition, work should be visible, there's almost an implicit reading in the middle chunk of this paper. And which is why I appreciate when later they come back to be like, no, you can have positive invisibility as well. And for, you know, things like discretion, for example, factor in as well. But I did feel that for most of the paper, they're focused on invisible work as almost an unsteady equilibrium or an oxymoron.
And they do use this term, right? The matrix of visible and invisible work, which I think it can help us also to structure our discussion, because I mean, just hearing you guys right now, I'm thinking of so many examples of, like, you know, making certain things visible work or counting them as work as having really negative consequences on workers and what they can do and how much discretion they actually need in order to perform their tasks on an everyday. So yeah, I think I'm looking forward to our discussion of how visibility can actually be a negative thing. But yeah, maybe now we can go into what Tom was saying on the conditions that make work invisible. And I agree with you, Tom, that discussion of creating the non-person, disembedding background work, and abstracting and manipulating indicators, which basically amount to making either the work or the worker or both invisible. I agree with you that it definitely has kind of like a negative connotation, because it's about not appreciating, it's about power, it's about class, and it has great implications for inclusivity in organizations. So maybe we can go into that.
Well, I was really, really touched by the example of the cleaner with a recipe book. Do you remember? Like, it's on page 19, where I guess, like, she wasn't purely a cleaner, but she was a domestic worker in a household. And yeah, she created like recipes and decor. She documented it in a book. She saw it as kind of a creative expression, kind of, you know, making her rather mundane work like interesting and fulfilling for her. And then at the end of her stint with this family, they asked if they could see the book. And then when she asked the book back, they said they lost it. And it was kind of her lifetime work, and she was hoping to preserve it for her children. And so, like, not recognizing how valuable that, you know, this was not work that was demanded of her. She just did it for herself. And, you know, it also gave meaning and fulfillment to what she did. And I'm sure the family benefited from her creative recipes and whatever she made and documented there as well. Yeah, and that kind of makes you realize, like, becoming a non-person is also not taking into account the feelings, the values, like the respect, the appreciation that certain forms of work deserve. And yeah, at the end, Starr and Strauss say, like, creating a non-person need not be a monolithic event. Every workplace and organization employs people who may give or receive such a status, even only partially. And I was like thinking about us as academics, where, you know, we sometimes also get rendered into a non-person, you know, being looped into teaching faculty where they just need teachers to get a course done without looking at, okay, how I'm going to fit this into my life, like how I'm going to structure it, what can I bring to the course? I don't know how you call it, but kind of the standardization of work. When they prescribe so much how it needs to be done, it also has like an element of becoming a non-person in a way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and of course, we also have to be mindful of being on the other flip side. I know in my organization, we constantly reinforce among our faculty just how valuable, remember how valuable your educational technicians are. I don't know, each institution probably calls them different titles. But those whose work could be easily become invisible to you if you aren't paying attention, and you wind up under your own pressures, not necessarily treating those who are vital to your support for as you ordinarily would.
I was just going to say that I feel that we, in our discussion, are complexifying the matrix of visibility and invisibility, right? That was the main thing that we were trying to get at. Because I think that some of these invisibilities related to status, gender, you know, power dynamics, meaning that the social nature of power and who and what gets to count more or less. And this way, I think the issue here, and that's what you're referring to, is, of course, invisible work can be positive, but in this case, they're invisible workers or discounted workers. So not only visibilities are created similarly, right? They don't go as far. This is implicit in the paper, but that's the idea that some invisibility denies people with respect, as you're saying, Grit, or recognition more generally, right? Others actually can be enabling in terms of discretion and so on. But then you brought this other example of academics that actually made me think of a different source of invisibilization, which is not so much status, but actually organizational structures, right? This impersonalization that is required in larger form organizations. And as you're saying, that needs to fit particular standards and routines. And then for better and worse, you know, we become, anyone can become the famous cog in the machinery.
And to add to that, I also enjoyed reading about the invisibilization work that some workers do and making themselves visible even when they see themselves as invisible. So this person that applied for a job as a cleaner in a household, and then when the head of the household was kind of hesitant to hire her because she looked too well dressed, and then the work that this, it was a lady, put into looking like she put old rags on in clothing, and she put her head down and she adjusted her posture. She was adjusting her language. So she was hired for the job and could do the job. So I would say, like, that is work that a worker puts in to become invisible. She's not the only one doing that. We may all do that to some extent in certain contexts. And then the other example of where, like, this cleaner had to do the laundry and she was just tired of it. And so she knew if she only washed out the soap of the laundry halfway, the clothing would turn brown. And then her boss, like the head of the household, kind of said, okay, I will just hire somebody to do it. And she said, I just had to take care of myself. And there was also another example where a person said, I had to take care of myself. So when you become invisible, or your work becomes invisible, or you become a non-person, can also mean that you take on more and more work. It becomes routine. It's standard. It becomes invisible. But then it's all on you. Like, who is checking if you can actually do it? By sometimes making it visible by resisting or sabotaging. Those are all forms of, you know, taking care of yourself, I guess.
Yeah, and Greta, your point brings me to actually something I found a bit, I would say a critique I have of this particular subsection, the creating a non-person. So, by the way, for the listeners, when we're talking about this matrix of visibility, invisibility, they essentially have three types, and you can think of the underlying, the latent characteristic as either the work is visible or invisible, or the worker is visible or invisible. And in this first type, they're saying that the work has to be visible, that everything is clean and happening, and then the worker is a non-person, invisible. But coming back to the critique of this particular type is they spend most of their time talking about dehumanization rather than invisibility. In fact, they have examples of really kind of egregious surveillance. So it's not, they want to see you working, kind of sweating, blood, sweat, and tears. What they don't want is to see you relaxing or kind of being human with emotions and things like that. And in fact, when they talk about resisting in this, in their subsection, you see that the title itself is resisting objectification rather than resisting invisibility necessarily. And a reason that conflation, I think, muddies the conceptual argument here is because it's all meaning systems. You could imagine a butler in Downton Abbey being super proud of creating invisibility, and the fact that, you know, we host 100 plus guests and ambassadors and whatnot, and none of my staff are ever seen. Everything is happening like clockwork. The last thing those people would want is to resist the invisibility, but they would likely still resist objectification and dehumanization. Yeah, and quick plug on this butler thing. I think it was in my mind because there's a great novel I read recently called Remains of the Day by Kazuo Ishiguro. Great evocation of the meaning systems of butlers in these old households.
I'd like to add to your critique because the section concludes with a one paragraph implications for computer-supported cooperative work. So basically, they're using these vignettes to lead to a discussion about, okay, then what do you have to, what does you take away for consideration of designing computerized systems? Although I wholly agree with what they say is that because of the invisibility of work and the dehumanization, if you're going to computerize a work process and you don't take and dig in and take into account all of this, and all you're going to be modeling is what's visible, which then could very well be a problem because it winds up in with a computer program that doesn't capture all of the work being done properly. I don't know that the arguments, the argument and the recommendation necessarily fully connected, but at least they derive that particular point, because that's exactly what went wrong with a whole bunch of automated process systems that followed. They computerized what was visible or the representation in the minds of the manager. And the end result is the computer system doesn't work to serve the needs of the organization, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I like how they bring it back to, why is this relevant for the discussion? Because they don't, like you said, Tom, like they don't only identify the negative consequences for the worker, which is, of course, this discussion that we've been mostly having about inequality and discrimination and exclusion. But there's also an interesting point to be made. You know, if you're visibilizing the work but invisibilizing the worker, then there's a bunch of stuff that the worker does that will remain hidden, right? Which they refer to as shadow work, as a kind of synonym of invisible work. So it has negative consequences for both society and the workers, but also for the organization and the work that they're trying to manage. And I think one thing that we kind of didn't mention in our discussion of the non-person is that they're building from government's work, which they do, again, ahead. So the non-person comes from Goffman, and it's about being stripped, they say this in the paper, being stripped from history, family, and defining markers. One becomes a number, not a name, right? So they do admit that it's not as extreme as it's described in Goffman's discussion of total institutions, but it does it does happen that way. And this is where the whole discussion of the non-person comes from.
Right. And it also plays in the next part, right? Where they talk about the disembedding of background work. And I pretty much read Goffman in there, like what is front stage, what is backstage. I believe they bring up this example of musicians where, you know, when they give a concert, it's very much front stage where you see an effortless, perfect performance and you're enjoying it. But what you don't see is the hours and hours of labor that went into practice, rehearsing, adjusting, refining. I also felt like, Tom, that connected to your point of, you know, when you automate things, what goes effortless and seamless might become invisible. And when you're automating things, you forget like what is happening in the back.
You know, it's kind of the contrast of the non-person. This is about the work is invisible, but the worker is visible, right? And I think, I mean, you guys brought up our kind of the work that we do in the previous one, but this is the one that most resonated with our work, right? Like we reward publications, right? But we don't take into account the like 5 or 10 years of constant work that it took to get there and the many rejections and not just the writing and rewriting, which sometimes cannot even be explained in a very rational step-by-step manner, but also all the kind of emotional work that goes into, you know, taking on rejections and moving forward and building, you know, the relational work of building networks that can kind of help you work, you know, with your papers and like all this stuff that we don't really see or reward or explain in a very clear way that you kind of have to go through it to learn how to do it. And this is all part of the invisible work that I see here, you know, that's happening in the background. And, you know, there's a huge discussion here, which I think it was important then, but I think it's still important now. And it's coming even more prominent in discussions of organizations, this idea of care work. And this is kind of the best example they give, right, of disembedding background work. So all the stuff that we do to kind of make our environments and the people around us better so that we can actually get the work that is visible and formal and rewarded possible. And this is all the work that is, it was invisible then. I think it's still invisible now, even though at least now we're having a discussion about it.
And that's where the negotiation component that they talk about actually plays out well, very much in the example of academia, where you might be going up for a review or for tenure or something, and you are trying to show all the invisible work. You're talking about how whatever I did XYZ or I helped in recruiting or whatever it is, and you're negotiating with, let's say, the dean or whoever it is to bring some of the invisible into the visible, because a lot of your outcomes depend on the visible. And I think since this paper was written and with computer, but also with the, you know, continued scientific rationalization of work, if everything is based on what is measured, then it becomes the negotiation has even more at stake, because it's your, you know, your pay, your kind of benefits, everything is based on what you can show visibly to others. Maybe this also is a good kind of segue to the third part, which is, so let me recap. The first dimension is the work is visible, the worker is invisible, so the non-person. The second dimension, the work is invisible, but the worker is visible, so care work, for example. And this third dimension seems to be both are invisible, the work and the worker. And it seems to be the case where you are trying to abstract away and manipulate what you are measured on itself. So one way I interpreted it is you're trying to do the work of changing the dimensions of visibility. You can think of it as changing your KPIs, your key performance indicators, and you're trying to influence what gets measured. And that work of influencing what gets measured is invisible, and you stay invisible while doing it. Again, this one was a bit confusing, so I'm curious about any thoughts any of y'all had on this.
I was kind of along the same lines. This is the invisible work that some of us as young staff officers used to do to make the statistics look good. Finding ways to run through regulations to find those things that could get the boss in trouble and trying to manipulate the situation in a way that we present the story, you know, either fix what is visible or come up with a really good and useful explanation that will allow the boss to keep his job. Was it? Statistics are lies, damn lies. And there's a phrase there from Mark Twain. I'm trying to remember it. Oh, three forms of lies. Lies, damn lies, and statistics. That's what it was. But that's when we're talking about, you know, sort of joking, invisible work and invisible person. That's an example of it, of basically that inner circle who tries to help prevent or deal with things when they don't go according to plan. I mean, it's like all articulation work in that instance. But obviously, that's a little different than the examples that they came up with.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think more than the production of, you know, statistics and stuff to kind of manage what gets seen or not seen, I understood it more of the making management decisions about work and workers based on this kind of abstraction. So the way I understood this third dimension is basically you can make the worker and the work invisible in two ways. So one, you can create these kind of abstract indicators and then make decisions based on that. And of course, we know that these indicators are not going to, they're not seeing the work that gets done that is not measurable. And they're also not seeing the people behind, you know, the people that are actually doing that work. And then the other way in which both workers and work become invisible, it's there's a great distance between the product and actually the work and the workers, you know, involved in that product. And that one, I think we have so many examples right now, right? With delivery and like all this stuff that just appears in our doorstep, and we don't actually appreciate, you know, the kind of physical and emotional work that these workers are going through to get that stuff delivered to your doorstep, or everything else that, you know, that happens. You know, now you can get your groceries delivered to your house, where maybe a long time ago you would actually grow, you know, fruit and vegetables at your home, and you would kind of be more aware of the whole process. So I think that for me is what this third dimension was about.
The third dimension was also, to go back to the case of academics, right? To the metrics, right? To what and how, again, it's a different way to talk about not just status, but different ways through which work or the worker is made invisible, right? Because exactly what you're saying, what reward, what you measure is, in this case, publication, right? So we only see that, right? We don't see all of this relational work, care work that you're saying. But I think the funny thing, to go back what Greta is saying, is that that's a great example of an invisibility, despite the stress, anxiety, and unfairness that always embedded and baked into this, it's an invisibility of privilege, right? Because to some extent, one of the alluring sides of academic work is the autonomy. And the autonomy comes from being able to exactly decide who would and how would you like to construct the network through which people are going to support you and give you feedback. It's not pre-established and it goes well beyond your own organization that employs you, and so on and so forth. So it's like a delicate thing that at the same time, yes, as Raheem was saying, we find ourselves having to make it visible sometimes and accountable, especially in moments of measurement, because the metrics are such that makes this invisible, it renders such labor invisible. But at the same time, it's actually what is so alluring about the job.
That's a good point, Pedro. And I'm also thinking about like what role context plays here. For instance, some forms of work are kind of embedded in certain jurisdictions and occupations have like memberships, like for instance, medical professions, lawyers. Probably you can think of a few more, and they have occupational standards. For instance, doctors need to have a certain amount of training in order to retain their license. If they don't meet the criteria and the points for training, they lose their license. But how much of that work is actually being recognized by the context in which they are employed? Because they might assume, you know, that the stuff you have to do in your free time. So they're also thinking about academics. We have like a teaching environment, which is often within our university, but then we also have a research context. This might be the field that we're studying, where you have to build connections, the emotional labor, negotiating access, which for field workers is often rendered invisible in our academic departments, especially by people that don't do the same type of work. Or I don't know if it's an active process, but it's often unseen. Let's put it like that. And then there's also our academic community, where you're actually collaborating with co-authors in different universities, in different schools, perhaps even across disciplines. So there are all these layered contexts in which much work today is embedded. But then the indicators, was that the right word, of what counts as real work are often defined by one context, the one that pays your salary. But the criteria to meet those indicators and what you need to do is often set by those other contexts. And that just makes it very, very complex.
So, yeah, I mean, and maybe this is a good way to summarize kind of part one, because they, as part of the discussion about what is work, they do talk quite a bit about the context, and they use this example of a movie where there's a Western ecologist somewhere in Africa talking to a tribesman about what the ecologist does, and the ecologist says, "I follow elephants around and pick up their dung," because they don't understand the larger term. So he just goes down to the level of activity, and then when he explains the activity, the other person thinks they must be crazy. And then there's a very nice, well-written sentence in this paper where the authors say, essentially then, lacking a mutual context, all that is visible is the unadorned action. And so without context, it's just unadorned action.
The movie reference was The Gods Must Be Crazy. It is one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. Highly recommended to anybody who has never seen it.
Maybe we should dedicate an episode to it.
It'll be a tough one to put an organizational framework towards, but I suppose it could be done.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.